Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mislaid Magician, or 10 Years After, by Patricia C. Reedy and Caroline Stevemer. Narrated by Lucy Rayner. February. The 24th of February, 1828. Tangleford Hall, Kent. Dearest Kate, it was splendid to see you and Thomas and your boys again this fortnight past, and I still think that baby Lawrence is the image of his papa, even if he is still quite bald. In deference to Thomas's feelings, however, I shall not mention the resemblance again until little Lawrence is old enough to have grown some hair. My only regret is that we could not stay longer at Skeynes. You have turned it into such a comfortable home that I do not wonder at your reluctance to go up to London. Though I do hope James and I can coax you all to visit Tangleford next summer, so that we may return your hospitality. 2 weeks was hardly enough time to catch up on all of your doings of the past few months. I know James was as sorry to leave as I, and as for the children, well, you saw how baby Alexander cried when we left, and Diana and the twins all sulked for 2 days straight. I had expected it of Diana, who was only 4 after all. But I had hoped that at the age of 9 the twins would have grown out of such tricks. Apparently, it takes longer than that. Speaking of the twins, I'm afraid Arthur has confessed that he and Eleanor sneaked into Thomas's study on the last day of our visit. Eleanor has been suffering from a trifling ailment since we left, no more than a bad cold, but Arthur was convinced that it must be the result of some dreadful magical protection they had triggered, and so he poured out the whole story to James and me the night after we arrived home. I do not know where he can have come by such a notion, but he was so earnest in his concern that both James and I had difficulty in keeping a sober expression. I promise you that we did so, however, as neither of us wishes to encourage him to undertake any similar adventures in the future. Poking about in a wizard's study is serious business. The reason I mention it is that Thomas may need to readjust his warding spells. I am still not entirely sure how Arthur got past them. Please do let me know if you should discover it. And I wish you would advise me whether Thomas maintains a continuous scrying spell on the gazing ball in his study. Arthur claims to have seen things in it, and if he is neither making up tales nor using an existing spell, I may need to find him a magic tutor who can oversee more advanced work than his present teacher. James is going up to London to consult with the Duke of Wellington. I suppose I ought now to say with the Prime Minister, but I am not yet accustomed to thinking of him so. Though I am not sure what the Duke has in mind this time, I am quite pleased for him by this turn of events. James becomes bored and most unhappy when he does not have enough to do, which is a habit I'm sure he picked up on the peninsula when he was aide-de-camp to Lord Wellington. And whatever the Duke needs, I doubt it will be boring. At first, I had hoped to go to London along with James, but both baby Alexander and Diana show signs of coming down with Eleanor's cold, and I really cannot leave Nurse to manage them all alone, most especially if Arthur is going to remain in good health, for he is sure to get into some scrape while her back is turned, and she has a decided partiality for him that sometimes persuades her to be less firm with him than she ought. Indeed, I'm feeling nearly as sulky as the children, for I had been looking forward to seeing Aunt Elizabeth and Mr. Rexton again. What with Mr. Rexton's work at the Royal College of Wizards, they are so firmly settled in London now that it is nearly impossible to induce them to visit outside the city. I cannot bring myself to call Mr. Rexton Uncle Michael, though he and Aunt Elizabeth have been married these 10 years. I suppose I have never quite got out of the habit of thinking him as my magic tutor. I especially wanted Mr. Rexton's opinion of the discursive chain cantrips Thomas and I had that disagreement about. I had also hoped to order a few gowns in advance of the season, and to review the redecorating of our townhouse. For you know that now the Duke is to become Prime Minister, we shall have all kinds of distinguished persons visiting, so it is most important that everything be properly done. Now it must all be left to the last minute, for James is quite hopeless at such things. I dare say he would not notice, even if the drapers put crimson drapes in the blue salon. It is most provoking, and of course I cannot complain of it to James, so I write to you instead. Love, Cersei.
The 25th of February, 1828. Tangleford Hall, Kent. My dear Thomas, the eldest of my young hellions has confessed to sneaking into your study near the end of our visit. The offence has already met with suitable punishment, but I trust you will let me know of any damage or disruption that he has not seen fit to mention. He has not provided any reason for the excursion, other than a desire to see a real wizard's study. Sometimes I think he takes after my dear Cecilia a little too much. I am off to London as soon as may be. Wellington's summons was waiting for me when we arrived home. I'm not yet entirely sure what the business is about, which will tell you a good deal right there. Unless he has good reason, old Hookey has always been clear about his orders. I infer that the matter is serious. I need not tell you to be discreet. Cecilia stays here with the children. I shall write when I know more and tell you what I can. Yours, James.
The 27th of February, 1828. Skeynes. Dear Cecy, I do hope full health has been restored to the Tarleton household by the time you read this. To be honest, it is but a faint hope, for things here at Skeynes are just as disease-ridden. All sniffles and coughing, hot bricks and red flannel. Nothing serious, thank God. This, too, shall pass, and you'll have your chance at London before you know it. It will be lovely to see the Rextons again. I agree that it would be vastly preferable to have a bit of extra time with the dressmakers and drapers for once, but I'm sure that you will work your customary wiles upon them, and that no one would ever suspect you accomplished so much in so very little time. The same mail coach that brought your letter has brought us another visitor, Georgie. She arrived with only one maid, can you believe it? And we had not a word of warning she intended to come. Hardly the distinguished behaviour one looks for from Her Grace, the Duchess of Waltham, you'll agree. More to this than meets the eye, says Thomas darkly. So I'll leave you to get to the bottom of it. And off he gallops to Waycross. Thomas claims he needs to see if the damage from the flooding is as bad as the man of affairs there says it is. Provoking man. He knows I know floods are a matter of utter indifference to him. Until they intersect with his comfort, that is. So why not just stay here while I get on with interrogating Georgie? One might have wondered if there were a warrant out for his arrest. He set off with such speed. Anyone would think that a journey to Waycross in this weather was a high treat. Come to think of it, given the sniffles and the coughing, it might have been a bit of a relief to the poor man to get away from the sound of sick babies crying. Not that he's objected to much of that, thanks to blessed Nurse Carstairs. Without her, Cecy, I shudder to think what life would be like. Something akin to that big painting at the Royal Academy. You remember the one, with Thomas in a long white beard as Ossian, and the children and me as his faithful followers, huddled at his feet, wearing nothing but plaid blankets. Lawrence would do very well, swaddled in a plaid blanket, but I shudder to think how dirty Edward's feet would get. They're quite dirty enough now, with half the staff reminding him to put his shoes back on. Enough of that. I can't tell you anything about sick babies that you don't know from experience. All of this vapouring is by way of explanation of why I haven't yet told Thomas about the incident of Arthur and Eleanor and Thomas's study. He was off before I'd even opened your letter. When he comes home, I will be sure to tell him. I cannot help but admire the persistence the children showed, for that door is not often unlocked. You know your children best, of course, but I would not wonder if we learned that Arthur made the enterprise sound as if it were all his idea, in order to protect his dear sister. Eleanor, when in health, seems far more likely to have had the idea originally. If I have heard her ask Thomas once to show her a spell, please, I'm sure I have heard her ask him 100 times. She asks very nicely, of course, and there is no question that Thomas is the softest touch going when it comes to indulging a small girl's taste for such amusements. I don't fault her in the least for her interest. I merely point out that Arthur may have had a bit of help in entering the study. From the piercing cries that have just begun to emanate from the nursery, I should judge that someone has spilt boiling water on a lion, or Edward has frightened one of the maids, or Lawrence has awakened from his nap. The only thing that rules out the possibility of all three is the happy circumstance that we do not own a lion. My appearance on the scene will only intensify the din, but if I don't demonstrate a proper degree of concern, Edward will keep finding ingenious new ways of frightening the maids, and that will never do. So I leave you, says he, precisely as you last saw me, halfway to distraction, but still your devoted Kate.
March. The 1st of March, 1828. Tangleford Hall, Kent.
Dearest Kate, Georgie arrived on a mail coach, with only one maid, of all the utter goose caps.
Depend upon it, the news will be all over the town within a week, and all the gossips will be saying that she has run away from her husband.
I don't suppose that is what she has done.
If she has, it would be the first piece of good sense she's shown in years, and coming straight to you would be the second. The gossips cannot make a mysterious elopement out of it if Georgie is known to be staying with her sister, after all. I hope she does not keep you guessing as to her purposes for too long. The season will be starting soon, and once it does, her behaviour is certain to be the primary topic of conversation. Fortunately, it will probably not be long before some new scandal arises, but in the meantime, I should like to be prepared with whatever story the pair of you decide to set about. Or, more likely, with whatever story you and I decide to set about, as Georgie is seldom of any help in such matters. It is just like Thomas to abscond at such a moment. As regards Thomas's study, I am quite certain that Eleanor was up to her pigtails in the matter, right along with Arthur. But even I would not venture to guess which of them was more responsible to begin with. Had I been able to interrogate them both immediately after Arthur's revelation, I might perhaps have discovered more. But Eleanor was too ill at the time, and now it is much too late. Arthur may take after me, as James often asserts, but I think Eleanor is more like you, which may have something to do with Thomas's susceptibility to her wiles, at least as regards concocting plausible tales. On re-reading my letter, I see that it sounds rather snappish. Do believe that I am not out of reason cross with Georgie. She has always been a pea-goose, and I suppose she always will be. I am simply out of sorts this morning. James has been gone since Monday. The children are all absolutely full of colds, except for Arthur, and running nurse ragged, and Arthur has been running me ragged. I expect I had best tell you the whole, but you are not to worry. Last night, I was sitting up rather late over my books. What with the children's illnesses, it was the first opportunity I had had to look over the copy of Gregorius's Arcana that Thomas so kindly loaned me. It was well past 11 when there was a soft rap on the study door, and a moment later, Arthur slipped in. I was at first inclined to read him a lecture, for though I do not keep so complex a magical laboratory as Thomas's, I try not to neglect my arts, and the children all know that they are not allowed to interrupt when James and I are in the study. But Arthur was plainly much agitated. His eyes were wide, and he was as tense as one of the strings in your pianoforte. "Mamma," he said before I could speak, "I am very sorry, but there is somebody outside in the garden, and I think he is trying to get in." "Is there indeed?" I said. I marked my place and set the book aside, then rose in a leisurely fashion, for I have found that a show of great calm is very reassuring to agitated children. I was not nearly so sanguine as I appeared, however. Arthur is a creative child, but not generally an over-imaginative one, and so I had every dependence on the accuracy of his statement. "You did very well to come to me first, instead of alarming the servants," I told him as I snuffed the candle. "Now show me." We went down the hallway and across to the back of the house. There is a small, oddly shaped room there that is used mainly for storage. The window bows out over the back of the house, and moonlight was streaming in. Arthur scrambled into the window seat and pointed. At first, I did not see anything. Then the bushes below the scullery window shook and wobbled, and the dark figure of a man emerged. All I could determine with certainty was that he was of medium height, for he wore a workman's cap and a jacket that seemed to be several sizes too large for him. He brushed himself off and started toward the next window. I was not much concerned, for he must have tried several of the rear windows before he reached the scullery, and the wards were holding. I was therefore tolerably sure that he was no magician. I whispered to Arthur to be very quiet and not move, and then I cast the greater cessation. Fortunately, it is not a long spell, if one already has solid wards in place to use as a base. Arthur was, surprisingly, a model of decorum. I finished the spell and looked down, expecting the prowler to be frozen in place. Instead, I saw him continue to move, though very slowly, as if someone had attached lead weights to his arms and legs. His head turned, and then he began to... Well, run is not precisely the right word, as even baby Alexander could have caught up with him easily. Still, it was clear that he was trying to run, and he did succeed in moving, and the farther away from the house he got, the faster he went. I shook off my surprise and turned to Arthur, who was staring, wide-eyed. "Go and fetch Mr. Hennessy," I told him. He barely took time to nod before he bolted for the door. Needless to say, I did not sleep for the rest of the night. First, I set Hennessy and the footman to scouring the grounds. Though I had very little hope that they would find anything, I thought that the evident activity would discourage any further attempts at intrusion. Then I took Arthur around the house to review the wards with me. He is not, of course, advanced enough in his studies to cast the wards himself, and while I could certainly attune them to him, as they are already tuned to James and myself, I had no intention of doing so. But by the time I finished explaining matters to Hennessy, it had become quite clear that Arthur was far more thrilled than frightened, and that for the promise of a farthing 2 years hence, he would have happily joined in the search. I wished to give his thoughts another direction, as I do not want to have to roust out the entire household again tomorrow night to look for Arthur. So I impressed upon him the importance of the house warding spells, and told him that, as he is responsible for his sisters and baby Alexander while James is in London, I would show him how to read them tomorrow. I am about to go fulfil my promise. He is quite far enough advanced to learn the simplest of the warding cantrips, and I hope that it will keep his mind safely occupied. I expect, however, that for the next several days, at least, I will be informed of every thin spot in the warding spell almost as soon as it develops. Hennessy and his fellows found no trace of our prowler. As soon as I finish with Arthur, I intend to set a lesser ward about the grounds near the house. Nothing strong enough to be noticeable, just a sort of alarm bell to let me know of any unanticipated visitors. It is all very well to say that I would have known immediately if he had somehow managed to get through the house wards, but I find that I would very much rather to know of his presence before the house wards were breached. The consensus in the lower hall is that the prowler was some itinerant hoping to steal food, or perhaps a little money. This seems plausible, as anyone who knew Tangleford Hall would know that there is a magician in residence, and would therefore have anticipated the house wards. The only flaw in this argument is the peculiar way in which the prowler evaded the holding spell I cast. I have not pointed this out to anyone. The servants are quite upset enough as it is. Since I have not heard from James, I expect he will be home in another day, or perhaps two. He is very good about keeping me informed when he is away, but he is far more casual when he knows he will return soon. For once, I shall have news as interesting as his to tell him. "You're exhausted," says he. The 1st of March, 1828. Skeynes.
Dear Ceci, I hope this letter finds you and the children well. I congratulate you on having dealt exceedingly well with your prowler. Indeed, you have almost convinced me not to be alarmed on your behalf. But only almost. Do take care, Ceci. Forgive me. I know you do. Thomas is not yet home from his venture to Waycross. Thus, I have yet to tell him of the intrusion into his study. Nor has Thomas yet seen the letter James wrote him, for it arrived in the post after he departed. I do hope it contains nothing of vital importance. Thomas has also missed his mother's latest letter. Lady Sylvia is in her usual fine health and spirits, busy as ever providing good counsel to the league of her old friends, most recently the proprietor of Ragnar's pastry shop in the Rue Saint-Honoré. Lady Sylvia helped Ragnar rid his kitchens of a spell that soured the milk and turned butter rancid the moment it arrived in the place. Ragnar had suspected a competitor of casting the spell to ruin his business, but no such thing. Ragnar's son, Lady Sylvia discovered, had devised a spell to keep pastry cream from ever curdling. This spell, as so many seemed to, had unexpected consequences. After a few false starts, Lady Sylvia was able to refine the pastry cream spell to prevent any further ill effects. Even Ragnar concedes the resulting pastries surpass all previous efforts. His gratitude to Lady Sylvia has been expressed in chocolate eclairs. I am sorry to report I have made no progress at all in fathoming the mystery of Georgie's visit to us. For all her sudden professions of fondness for the simple country life, from the moment of her debut, she has been happiest in London. Of all times to choose to rusticate herself, the beginning of the London season is about the least likely. I think I used to fault Georgie for being a watering pot. I would give a good deal for her to go off on one of her tearful flights just now, for when she cried, I could nearly always get her to tell me what was troubling her. These days, unless she is being disagreeable to the servants, she is as stoic as a soldier. Georgie being Georgie, she is in her very best looks. Pale silence has always suited her best, I fear. The only time she smiles is when she is talking with Edward. Indeed, when she is talking with Edward, there are moments when Georgie looks only a little more than 6 years old herself. Perhaps I refine too much upon Georgie's abrupt arrival. Perhaps there is no mystery about it. Perhaps it is only that she had a whim to see Thomas and me, precisely as Georgie insists. Yet consider. Georgie refuses all social engagements, neither paying calls nor receiving any. She waits for the post with such fidelity I could set the clock by her. Yet she seems relieved rather than disappointed when she receives no letters. Strangest of all, she devotes hours to reading the scandal sheets and even the newspapers. It is most unlike her. What of Georgie's husband, you ask? I wish I could tell you. His name has not crossed her lips. No message has come to her from him, nor, to the best of my knowledge, has she posted even a line of correspondence to him. The only assurance I could wrest from Georgie, and only after I reminded her at some length that it is the duty of sisters to protect one another, is that he has not mistreated her in any way. Georgie is not afraid of him, I swear, but she is afraid of something. I think she's hiding here, Ceci. Georgie has made me promise to keep her presence here in strictest confidence. Of course I will do so, but I made her grant me an exception in your case. I cannot imagine that anyone would ask you Georgie's whereabouts, but you will be in London soon, and you may well encounter some unlooked-for social circumstance there. So please do bear it in mind that Georgie is not really here at all. I know you will handle matters far more adroitly than I would, so we trust you with this secret. Believe that I will write the moment I learn anything else pertinent to the matter, or indeed, the moment I learn anything pertinent to anything. Writing to you is the one spot of civilization in a daily routine dominated by wailing children, muddy shoes, and wet dogs. With all the usual best wishes, and even more affection, Kate. The 3rd of March, 1828. Tanglefoot Hall,
Kent.
Dearest Kate,
the children are much better, by some measures, which is to say that they have reached the stage in their recovery at which no persuasion, no bribery, and no force can keep them abed. I shall be exceedingly glad when James returns. I had a note from him this morning, at long last, saying that he had expected to be back yesterday, but needed to remain in London a few more days. He includes no further details, save that he anticipates returning by the end of the week. I find this rather odd, for it is most unlike the Duke of Wellington to call James urgently to town merely to chat, and then send him home again. I do hope that James is not staying to have the blue salon redone as a surprise for me, or anything similar. He is occasionally taken with such notions, and it does not do. But one really cannot lecture one's husband on the suitability of the surprises he chooses. And after all, it is quite pleasant that he still thinks to do such things at all, even after 10 years of matrimony. Georgie is an utter goose, but if she wishes her whereabouts to remain unknown to anyone, I shall oblige her. I suppose I can simply look down my nose like Aunt Charlotte and inform people sternly that I do not wish to discuss the Duchess of Waltham when they ask, but that very well may add fuel to the gossip once it begins. If Georgie wishes to remain undiscovered and undiscussed, it would be better to have some tale to set about. Perhaps a sudden, urgent need for the latest in French pelisses. No one will look for her at Skeynes if we set it about that she has gone to Paris to shop. There has been no sign of our prowler about the house or the nearby grounds, but yesterday I took Arthur out riding to work off some of his energy, and we found quite a mess out by the gazebo on the far side of the hill, near the ancient earthworks. It looked almost as if some amateur had been attempting to cast a spell, or perhaps cook a peculiar sort of dinner. There were chicken feathers and onion skins all over, a couple of broken sticks with charred ends, and random lines drawn in chalk here and there. I would have suspected the children, had they not been laid up all week. Arthur's surprise was evident, as was his desire to investigate everything at once. I made quite certain that there was no magical residue, and then let him collect feathers. He found a shiny silver button in one corner, quite flat, and polished to a mirror finish. If it belonged to the would-be magician, then he is no vagrant. I plan to test it tonight, after Arthur is safely in bed. I do wish James would come home. I have no particular concern about the prowler himself, of course, but I am growing more concerned about Arthur's fascination with the notion of discovering him. I spent considerable time and effort, very early this morning, placing yet another ward around the house, to detect anyone attempting to sneak out late at night. I could almost wish that Arthur would catch the cold like the rest of them, but he remains disgustingly healthy. Yours, Ceci.
The 4th of March, 1828. Skeynes. Dear James, in London are you? Bored rigid yet? Sincere apologies for my tardiness in replying to your letter. Rest assured that your young hellion has not damaged anything. I think I can promise that he won't be able to duplicate the feat. The fact that Arthur contrived to do it even once interests me. I look forward to my next interview with him, as I have it on excellent authority. My member of the League of Holy Matrimony had it from your member of the League, that the lad claims to have seen things in my big paperweight. A truly reliable gazing ball would come in very useful, so if he has found a way to create one, I owe Arthur a debt of gratitude. I can promise you that if I had a truly reliable gazing ball, I would never again return to my home weary from the hardships of the road to find my sister-in-law still visiting. Certainly not when the visitor seems to labour under the impression that she is hiding from a mysterious organisation that plots her demise. Not that I don't occasionally sympathise with the urge to plot her demise. No, if I had a truly reliable gazing ball, you would find me putting up at a quiet and comfortable inn, playing shove halfpenny, sampling the ale, and doing no harm to anyone. Instead, I return to find domestic chaos, and Kate, Edward, and the infant inflicted with streaming colds, whilst
Sample complete. Ready to continue?